Hey guys, welcome to Masters of the Game. Today's guest is Emma Varsi. She's the creative director of Elevate Studio, a lifestyle brand specializing in interior design, styling, and property maintenance. She's been in the game going on 8 years. Emma, welcome to Masters of the Game.
Thanks so much for having me, Branko.
No worries. Welcome aboard. It's fantastic to have you. I've been meaning to do this with you for a little while, as you know, and I'm glad you are here today. So welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Awesome. I normally go right from the beginning and like to start in somewhat of a chronological order.
Yes.
And like to sort of tell people's story right from the beginning, and I think it just makes a little bit more sense from a flow perspective. So if we can, let's start from the beginning. Tell us about where you were born. Describe maybe upbringing for us, what area you grew up in, where you went to school, family structure, those sorts of things.
All the fun stuff.
All the fun stuff.
So I am a Westie through and through. So I was born in Sunshine Hospital. I am a second generation Australian, so born to my amazing parents, Bill and Silvana. I better mention them because I'm sure they'll be listening. And grew up in Hoppers Crossing. So that was majority of my upbringing and early life was pretty much Hoppers. And, you know, in a, I suppose, Sunshine and St Albans with my grandparents because European family, you know, mum was working from very, very young. So definitely had a huge impact with my grandparents pretty much helping raise me, you know. So,
good. Yeah. Where'd you go to school? Where'd you go to school?
Went to school, so Hoppers, Derrimut Heath Primary School, and then went to Westbourne for secondary.
Oh, there you go, me too.
Did you? I didn't know that.
I went for a portion of my schooling, so I went to Williamstown campus on Douglas Parade in the Strand for a year in grade four, and then from grade five to year nine, I was at good old Westbourne and Sayers Road.
Yeah, right.
There you go.
There you go.
Learned something new about you all the time. What was that experience like going to private school?
I think for me it was I felt a real sense of obligation because
– To yourself or to your parents?
To my family, yeah. So, you know, we grew up never really wanting for anything but always knowing that our parents were making a lot of sacrifices to send us to private school and to give us an opportunity in life that they perhaps – weren't able to have. So, yeah, I definitely felt that kind of pressure growing up that, you know, you're here, make it count, you know, something my mum will laugh hearing, I think, on this because she says it all the time, make it count, you know. So, yeah, it was – I loved it. You know, my son goes to the school now. My husband, Nick, went to the school. It feels like I'm plugging them. I've got to get a cut out of this.
We'll flick the podcast.
Yeah,
to them,
exactly. But no, it was great. I think the thing for me was it was private, but it was also very much like a Western suburbs private school in that a lot of families were in a similar position where they'd made a conscious choice to send their kids there, and it wasn't easy financially even back then, you know, to fork out for school fees.
So what years did you go there?
So I graduated in 2009.
2009, okay.
Yeah.
And you went there from what grade?
From year seven.
Year seven. So the entire secondary school.
Secondary school, okay. Yeah.
And what do you reckon the greatest thing you got out of going to private school versus, let's say, a school in the public system? So there's benefits for both.
Yep.
But for you personally, what do you reckon you got the most out of going to Westbourne?
I think for me it's the bunch of kids that I was surrounded with. In that because a lot of their parents had made those sacrifices to send them there, they probably also felt that obligation to do the right thing by their families. And I think speaking personally, I can't speak for anyone else, but I very much didn't want to go there. So I went to a public primary school and I was like the top of my game at that school. Like I ran that shit, you know. I was school captain. I had I was the youngest, you know, president of the school council committee and all that stuff. Like was doing it in, you know, grade four when it was a grade six job kind of thing, you know. So really felt like the big wig at that school. And with that comes a lot of ego. So I think my parents sending me to Westbourne, you go from that to then coming to that school, I wasn't the best. Mm. You know, there were kids that were brighter than me, and there were kids that probably pushed me to be better because the ego got a hit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It sort of humbles you a little bit.
It did.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Everyone's a bit more on the same level from an academic standpoint.
Exactly. Yep. So, yeah, there was that. But I really didn't want to go there. I remember, before year seven, driving on Sayers Road past the school and bursting into tears because none of my friends were going to the school. And I was just devastated that my parents had made that choice. I really didn't want to go. And then, of course, you get there and you do your thing and you make friends and you get comfortable you settle in.
Yeah.
But it does. I think it shapes you in ways that you don't expect it to. And then looking back now, I think it was probably the best thing.
Did you have to play sport and musical instrument when you were there? What sport did you play?
So I was soccer.
Because mandatory back then. I remember to choose a winter sport, summer sport and musical instrument.
Yes, yep. So we didn't have to do the musical instrument thing. It was just, the sport. So we played, soccer and I played softball. And then the second I could, I was on the touch rugby team.
Yeah, really?
Moved across to that. But, sport for me was never like a big influence. Yeah. I was always trying to get out of it.
And yeah, more the creative side was was you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like every lunchtime, every opportunity I could get after school lunchtimes, I was in the art room creating and took on way too many art subjects in year 11 and 12 and had all the folios and I think –
So when you say you're creating though, what painting or sculpturing or like
all
clay?
Of it.
All of it, yeah.
Yeah.
So has your creative spirit sort of started at a young age then by the sounds of it?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's always been there for me. And I think, it's funny because it was always there, but then when you have that sense of responsibility, sometimes you take a path that others expect of you.
Mm.
So I always wanted to do something in design or creative, field, but when I actually graduated from high school, I studied primary school teaching. So that was the first, course I did, I suppose, and first uni degree that I embarked on. And I didn't do it for very long, to be fair. I did my first it's actually my second round of placements at RMIT and went into the classroom and I was studying primary school teaching and went in and tied one of the boys' shoelaces and it was wet. And, the classroom teacher sitting there, she's like having a giggle at me. And then I'm thinking, what's she laughing at? Anyway, I'm tying these boys' shoelaces and whatever. And then she pulled me aside, and said, "You can't tie the boys' shoelaces, mate." And I'm like, "Why?" She goes, "Because why do you think they're wet? They're in the boys' toilets, like full of wee. Like, don't be doing that." So, I was like, "Oh, I don't know if this is for me." I didn't last long.
What made you gravitate towards teaching out of all things that, given that you're sort of a creative spirit, what made you go through from it to, I suppose, the educational side of things?
I think I've always had a passion for nurturing and education,
okay.
I think, in a sense, which definitely flows through to what I'm doing now as a leader in our business. I think the biggest thing, the main reason that I did it was that probably that expectation of like, make sure you get a job and, don't do the creative thing because there's no guarantees and it's a bit fear-led, I think, that decision.
So
when
what,
I look back on it.
So what do you think you – well, not what do you think. I'm sure you'll have an answer for this, but did your parents then have an expectation of what sort of career they wanted for you?
I think –
particularly going to Westbourne.
I think my parents would – and have always been very supportive of everything that I've done, but there was definitely that expectation of, like, make sure you get a job. Don't go through all this effort, all this work to then do something that there's no guarantee at the end of the day.
Sort of make something of yourself.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Make it worth it, And at the end of the day, it was my decision. I think, had I have really stuck to my guns and had that confidence that I would be really successful in a creative field early on and really showed my parents that conviction, they would have supported me. Mm. So, but I think I put that pressure on myself, like, don't fuck this up, do the right thing kind of thing.
Nothing wrong with that, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
But I don't regret it. I think, it was a great experience and all the things that you do in life, I think, lead you. Yeah.
So then on your parents, just because obviously we've tied a fair bit back to them already in this conversation.
Yeah.
They grew up here in Australia, I assume. Were they born here or were they born overseas?
Both of them were born here.
So both born here?
Yeah.
In what? How old are you folks?
So mum had me when 50s, she 60s? Was – oh, she's 50. Yeah, they're both 50s. Yeah. They haven't ticked over to 60 yet. So they're babies.
So they're born in the 1960s?
I think mum's 68.
Yeah, okay.
So I don't know what that makes her. Yeah. And then dad's 3 years older than
her. So in the hippie era.
Yeah.
In the hippie era.
Exactly.
So then your grandparents –
yes.
They migrated here then, I assume.
They did.
Yeah, okay. Yep. So they're Maltese background.
Maltese background, both sides.
And what year did they come to Australia then? When did they migrate, do you know?
It was...
like, was it immediately after the Second World War or was it more 50s, 60s or...?
Nah, I feel like it was... it would have been like early 60s, I reckon.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. To mid maybe even. Like it wasn't early. Like they're, you know, relatively speaking, like when you think about, you know, European immigrants, like it's more recent than I've got friends of mine who, you know, fourth, fifth generation Italian immigrants, you know. But no, our family's not that. It's very recent. Okay. And it came, you know, very much from a place of like opportunity and there's a lot of poverty, you know, really, where they came from and difficult upbringings on sort of both sides. So, yeah, they've been a huge inspiration. Yeah.
So you said before in the conversation that or previously us speaking that your grandparents had a lot to do with your upbringing. So so when you were but a baby, what sort of things did you pick up or what sort of memories do you have, I guess, if you like, of that time or if any? I mean, we don't have a lot of really early memories as kids, obviously, but your earliest memories of when you were growing up and when your grandparents were sort of helping raise you.
Yep.
What sort of memories are indelible in your mind that you can go back to and say, hey, I remember when, dot, dot, dot?
I think it's I just feel like an overwhelming sense of love, you know, from the family and lots of lessons. Like there's just so many things that over the course of my childhood they were able to teach me and perhaps even like indirectly, not just directly. It's things just observing, you know, their way of life and the way that they – conduct themselves and, you know, I mean, these are people who didn't have a lot. Like it's not like it is now. And it's so funny because when you think about like my grandparents' generation, there's so much now that as I'm getting older, I actually want to go back and start to live like elements
more
of,
simply, yeah.
Yeah. Of that simple life. And, you know, they had like my mum's parents, my nunu has the veggie garden and, you know, the chooks and, you know, he bred rabbits in the backyard and, you know, all that beautiful stuff. But it's stuff that my parents moved so far away from. It was like, okay, let's, you know, not so much have that. Let's have the, you know, big house and run the business and very much hard work all the time, no break, no rest, like just keep going, you know, let's get it. And it was kind of they, I think, and I'm speaking on behalf of, you know, them, but I feel like they have felt that same obligation of like our parents moved from this other country to give us a better life. Like let's not dwindle that. Mm. Let's make sure that this life that we're living and the legacy that we're leaving for our kids is one of, you know, wealth and prosperity and, you know, all those things. Whereas it's funny because now I'm that next generation and, you know, certainly wasn't raised with a silver spoon, but I had what I think a very privileged upbringing and I wouldn't change it and I loved everything about the way that we were brought up. But definitely now as a mother, I think for me I'm trying to get back to our roots a little bit and, yeah, teach Andre the more simple things in life and like relearn those things that you kind of stray from.
Did your grandparents live close by? Were you guys like in the same suburbs or other side of Melbourne or?
No. So we grew up in Hoppers and my mum's parents, St Albans, and dad's parents were North Sunshine.
Okay. So not too far away.
Yeah.
So you all had easy access to each other and you were pretty well connected and with obviously with each other a fair bit.
Yeah. Mum, you know, was back at work, I think I was like 6 months old or something when she went back to work. So my grandma looked after us, and she's such an incredible woman, my mum's mum. She looked after kids, and, you know, it's in that era where, you know, the husband goes to work and the wife stays home, but she always contributed, you know, financially in her own little way. So she'd look after like the neighborhood kids, and they'd come and have, you know, a little daycare at Nana's house. There'd be a whole horde of them in the kitchen, and very giving woman. But yeah, there was, you know, a time there where she pretty much raised us, and, you know, mum would very early on the train in the morning, you know, leave for work and drop me off, and yeah, come home and pick me up late at night, and then do the whole routine. And mum's been like instrumental in, I suppose, showing me that you can do both if you've got the support, you know.
So while we're on mum, then, you know, mum Sylvana's a pretty smart woman.
Oh, she's the weapon.
Describe her for me.
Mum is very, very clever, hyper organized, driven. She is the most selfless person that I've ever come across in my life. Everyone, you know, has, I suppose, a different outlook on their parents to, you know, what other people might have. But for me, like, she's honestly such a hero to me. There's absolutely no way I would be where I am today if it wasn't for the countless sacrifices that woman's made on my behalf, directly. Like, you know, when I had Andre, she quit her job and looked after him full time so that I could still have a career and a life, you know.
What sort of work was mum doing at that time? What was her career?
So she worked in legal for many years. So she was an account manager, basically. Not account manager, that's the wrong term. Like a trust account person.
Okay.
Yeah.
So numbers person.
Numbers person.
Yeah.
Yep. So money.
Yeah, yeah.
So she, yeah, handled, you know, the trust account and the bookkeeping and all of that for a couple of law firms. She worked in the city when I was very young. And then once Adrian, my brother, and I were at school, she moved to a firm in Werribee. And then as we got a bit older, she moved to a firm in Williamstown.
So she was very much a career woman.
Oh, yeah.
At that time, yeah.
She worked always working.
So then she sounds like she's given that up entirely.
Yep.
When your son was born, which we'll talk about a little bit down the track. But so, yeah, speaking of sacrifices, that's an immense one to help help you chase your
dreams. At her age too, because like that, she was very young, you know.
How old would mum have been at the time?
She would have been 44.
44, so that's very young.
Yep.
Very young.
Very young.
Middle age.
Yep. To, you know, quit her job. 44, 45, yeah. Quit her job and, yeah, look after a grandchild at 45. Like,
great woman.
Weapon, yeah.
Great woman, a weapon. Mm-hmm. I like how you call it a weapon. It's good. And then on the flip side, what sort of emotion comes to the fore when I mention your dad, Bill?
He's so special, my dad. Dad's like the Terminator.
I've been told that you're basically the female version of him.
Oh God, I hate to admit it, but you're probably not wrong there. Yeah, my dad's the best. He's like, you know, the larrikin that'll get everyone up and laughing and having the best time. And he just loves so like deeply, but he also doesn't show it. He's just one of those, you know, stoic, you know, kind of men. But oh, he's the best.
Have you always had a close relationship with Dad?
Yeah. I mean, look, when you're a teenager, there's always going to be things that you do that upset your parents.
Of course.
Especially when they're making those sacrifices and you're, you know, perhaps deviating from the plan. So I think I gave him a bit of trouble and but all in all, just an immense amount of respect for Dad. He's such a good person.
The father-daughter relationship's very special, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it really is. It's for me, I think probably the best example of what I needed to find in a partner I got from Dad, because it's all the good things about him. You know, it's like the loyalty and the respect and the way he treats my mum and the way he treats us kids and putting family first, like all those examples.
All the stuff you've observed in their behaviour as opposed to necessarily listening just to what they say, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. exactly. It's all the lessons that you learn from your parents, I think, if they're good or bad, you know, but it's from like watching and
What did he do for work and what does he continue to do for work?
So dad's a licensed plumber. He's also a builder. So as long as I remember, dad was always working, you know, 6-7 days a week, helping people, you know, family and friends and so on every opportunity that he could outside of, you know, outside of work. He'd be working on people's houses for free, you know. You know how it is. But, yeah, just such a great human.
Putting other people first by the sounds of it always.
Oh, always. Like I've never seen my dad put himself first, which it teaches you other lessons too, you know. Like there's a level of admiration, obviously, but then there's also those lessons of burnout, you know, and just looking at the way that that generation live and continue to live and wanting something maybe a bit different. And that's what why I talk about going back to, you know, maybe some of those things that our grandparents did, you know, having the veggie garden and, yeah, being able to cook that kind of humble food and, you know, do all those things for your family. I think, yeah, you kind of get to pick and choose when you've had exposure to both, which has been good for me.
Now, baby boomer generation post-Second World War II, the prosperity of the world and particularly the Western world post-Second World War II certainly looked very different, and all the opportunity that came their way, they looked at things differently than what your grandparents and my grandparents did and the opportunities that were afforded them. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And then our kids now are afforded different opportunities again. So.
Well, that's it. And then, you know, it's that obligation, I think, for us to teach our kids that hey, this is a very good life. Like what you're doing and what you're giving, this isn't normal.
You just need perspective. You need to teach them of where their parents and their grandparents have come from and what to get to the point that, you know, each generation should have it better than the last.
Yeah.
But you don't take for granted what those people put before you, if you like. I always say, you know, we all stand on the shoulders of giants or on the shoulders of many to get where we are, whether it's
absolutely
personally or professionally. So
definitely
lessons in there. So then just if we tie all that in then, how much would you say then, I guess, as a whole, your environment that you've grown up in, and the environment and the things that you've observed and seen and heard from your grandparents who you admire greatly and help raise you, from your parents who you absolutely adore by the sounds of things and rightly so by the way you've described them. How much then have they had a bearing, do you think, on the type of woman you've become and that you're continuing then to become?
I think it's been immense. I think it's also given me that opportunity to see the way that they respectively have lived their lives and then choose my life and the way that I want to live and the way that I want my children to live, or child to live. I think that I definitely wouldn't be the person I am today if it wasn't for them. But I think that we're intrinsically who we are, and for me, I mean, you try and put someone in a box sometimes and you try and put yourself in a box of like, oh, I need to be this way, I need to be this certain type of person, you know, to make them proud and to do right by the family and, you know, all those things. But who you are comes through if you like it or not. You know, so I think that they've definitely molded me and helped me and guided me down the journey of becoming who I am today. But I also feel like when you try and be who someone else wants you to be, not even if they want you to be it, it's if you think that they want you to be it sometimes, you know what I mean?
Sometimes you tend to fall over in that so-called pursuit.
Yeah. I think that it's almost like the universe has a plan, right? And the way that you get to that kind of destination can be really difficult or it can be easy. And I think when you follow your heart and your gut, it's easy. And when you go against it because you think you feel that pressure and you think you should be doing things to make other people happy or other people, they might not even have those expectations of you, but you put them on yourself. That's when it's hard. So I think for me, the early part of my career and study and all of that was hard. It didn't have to be, but I kind of made it hard because I wasn't following my truth. You know what I mean?
Got it.
Yeah.
But the grounding they've given you certainly helped keep you on that path.
Helped me keep me on the path.
When you veered, yeah. It sort of
they pull you in line re-centered
you, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
It's interesting when you look back and you think about it. But yeah, and I like how you called your old man the Terminator.
Oh, he doesn't stop.
I'm just laughing back at that from before. I know we veer off the topic a bit, but it was interesting. No encouragement, tenacious.
Yeah.
Just keep going, pushing through. It is that generation, and a lot of our parents are like that because that's just the way they were wired.
Yeah.
That's the way they were
And he's taught. The selflessness and that willingness to just like keep getting up every day. Like, you know, he's a plumber by trade, you know, his knees are busted and he still gets up out of bed and goes to work and it's cold and he's digging. And
how old's dad now?
I'm hopeless. I don't know. He'd be, 68?
He's been doing it for what, 30 years at least? 25 years, I would imagine.
Yeah, 30, like what, before I was born. So, yeah. You know, 35 years or something. Yeah.
It takes its toll on the body.
Definitely.
For sure.
There was one morning where, you know, he was working on a job not too far from my house. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to take the old bugger a coffee, you know. So went past the coffee shop, picked him and his friend Mario, who's worked with him for, you know, many years on and off, took them both a coffee and I'm sitting there, it was pissing down rain and they were digging, you know, all the, I don't even know the technical term for it, but, you know, the sewer and everything.
Trenches and
all
stuff.
All the trenches and, you know, they're in like knee deep mud and I was just like, far out. You don't realise as a kid, oh yeah, dad works hard, you know. But when you're, as an adult, I'm standing on that job site and I'm seeing him in the rain digging with his hand, like a shovel, you know, and they're on the machine and stuff, whatever. But like it's a whole nother sense of
appreciation.
Wow, you know, this is what you do every day for us.
Respect.
Yeah. Like this is not easy. Like admiration, you're not. Yeah. That's hard slog every day to get up and do that.
It's inspiring too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Sounds like you've had a pretty good grounding and pretty good base from which to grow up, which then leads to you meeting your husband, Nick.
Yes.
So he's the next phase of your life.
He is. We were babies.
So. How did you guys meet and where did you meet?
So we, how did it all come about? We both went to Westbourne, but Nick's older than me. So when I was in year 7, he would have been in year 12, I think. So we never knew each other at school. His younger brother, Justin, was the year above me at school and we were on the same bus. So I used to jokingly, you know, say to Justin, your brother's so hot. He's such a honey, you know, just like being silly and teasing. One day I'm going to hook up with your brother and just you wait. I was just joking around, you know. And then, yeah, years later, finished high school. There was a club out in Werribee that we'd frequent, you know, me and my best friend, Cartier. And Cartier's older brother and Nick were in the same year level at school. So Cartier sort of knew Nick that way and we're at the beer garden because that's where you'll find Nick because he's a smoker and as much as I hate to admit it, that's that's his life. So, you know, he was out in the beer garden having a ciggy and came over to Cartier to say hello and, you know, how's your brother, how's it all going? And then, you know, we just got talking and hit it off straight away and just ever the gentleman. And he's just, I knew straight away, it sounds so like tacky and, you know, love struck this like silly little girl. But I knew straight away when I met him that we were going to be together.
So what, you're 19, 20, something like that?
Yeah, I think I was 19. Yeah.
Young,
yeah,
isn't it?
So young. So it was the year, it was 2010 that we met, November 2010, right around like my brother's birthday. And so funny because the trajectory with him was so different to every other relationship or boyfriend or anything that I'd ever had. It's just so organic. Like he just felt like he was part of my life early on. I think he felt a little bit differently, like, oh, this, you know, young bird's so intense. And but, yeah, I just knew with him I just felt so much like myself.
So sort of just relaxed.
Yeah, like authentically. Yeah. Like he just has always brought out the best in me. And, yeah, there was when we first met, it would have been like – maybe 2-3 weeks into us being together, I didn't even think about it. Looking back now, it was such a weird move. But a couple of weeks into dating, I said to him, "Oh, come round, like I'm going to bake a cake, you know, come over." And of course, he's thinking, "Oh, come over, all right, like what's this about, you know?" And then he gets to my house and he's not just coming to see me, like my mum and dad and my brother are all in there.
Wow.
Anyway, and mum answers the door and she's like, "Oh, hi, you know, come in." And then, of course, you know, dad's sitting at the dining room table and he's sitting there like the good Maltese man he is, cutting his salami with his knife. And then he stabs the salami with the knife.
I'm sending a message.
And then he puts it in his mouth, has a bite, and then he points the knife at Nick and he goes, "Sit down." So that was, yeah, Nick's introduction to my family.
And then, what comes to mind when you think of your first date together?
He blew me away. I can't even – so, you know, I was so young that before him all my dates were like, "Oh, baby, let's go to La Poqueta," you know. And Nick took me out to, you know, the supper club in the city, like Spring Street, and it's this beautiful wine and cigar bar. And so, you know, I was just like, wow, this is like a whole new, like, world. I was so young and naive, like, when we met, like, really – to the world and to the way that things work. But I feel like we grew up together, you know, in that sense. And he was able to, yeah, just show me a side of me that I didn't even know that I had, and just was able to use a great word,
to bring it
elevate.
Out.
Yeah.
To bring it out. Yeah.
Just elevate who I was as a person, you know. But he's just always been like the kindest person. Like, you know, I'd be working at that time when he and I met, I was working in real estate, you know, 6 days a week, long hours. And one Saturday I was working, it was back to back opens. I mean, you know what it's like. And he rocked up at, you know, at work in between the inspections, and he brought me a sandwich, you know, that he'd like made. It wasn't just like a peanut butter sandwich, you know, like he'd made like a beautiful smoked salmon sandwich with the cream cheese and the alfalfa, and made like all these, and capers, made all this effort for me, you know. And that was the first time that anyone had given me that like self-worth, I think, in terms of like a romantic kind of partner.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like that value that he placed on me early on was just so special to me. And that's why I just knew. Yeah.
He told me about if you want to call it an episode, fishing on the Maribyrnong with him.
Oh, gosh. of course he did.
I don't know the story, but he just said, "Ask her about when we went to the Maribyrnong and we were fishing on the Maribyrnong together for the first time."
He's so cheeky. I'm not surprised that he brought this up. So Nick's a very keen fisherman. And, you know, at that point it was like – very early days in our relationship, and he'll tell you that moment was when he fell in love with me. I was like in love with him way before that, but he'll tell you that date. I think what it is up until that point, he probably didn't like realize that I'm like just a very relaxed, laid back person, because I think I give off the impression that I'm maybe not as much, you know. Especially in those days, it was all, you know, booted and, you know, looking the goods and high heels and all of that all the time. Working in real estate, was hyper polished all the time. But anyway, we went out on this date to the river and went fishing, and I'm like, "Babe, like I really need to go to the bathroom." I'm busting to go to the bathroom. And he's like, "Oh, well, there's no toilets here." Like I'm all like, he just set up all the gear and everything, and I'm like, "Well, like, what do you normally do when you go?" And he's like, "Well, do you need a wee?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I need a wee." And then he's like, "Oh, I don't know." And then he's like, "There's a bucket," like making a joke. And I'm like, "Oh, okay." So then I wait in the bucket. I can't believe he told you that. But yeah, that's when he fell in love with me, he reckons, because he was like, "Oh, she's like
keeping
a
it real.
A legit girl." Like,
keeping,
you know,
it real.
Yeah. I think, yeah, it's so funny.
I didn't know that, but he just said to put that out there and see what comes of it. So there you go.
Cheeky. He's very cheeky.
He's a little bit, but yeah. And then he said to me, obviously given what you do these days in terms of your line of work, he said to me, "So what are some other interesting things about Emma that we can maybe have a discussion about?" And he said to me, "I came home one day from work and I walked into the house and there was nothing but beanbags around." And he said, I thought we'd been robbed. I walked into the house and literally everything in the house was gone.
Yep.
I said, what do you mean everything in the house was gone? He said, we had no furniture in the house. It was just a number of bean bags, and that was pretty much about it, and a little bit of a few odds and ends here and there. I said, did you get robbed? Or he said, ask Emma what happened.
So that was very early days in the styling business. And we were growing, you know, the business has grown from strength to strength very organically since we started. But we got a job that landed, you know, last minute, and we just didn't have the right stock for it. But at home I had the right stock. So I used our own furniture. That poor man, I put him through the ringer. But it's always, I think, been – he's supported me wholeheartedly, you know, from the very beginning. Even when it – he's very selfless, you know. He'll put myself and my dreams and everything before anything else, which has served him well, I like to think. I think that's what you got to do. Like early days of business, you just got to sometimes make those calls and, you know, live without the dining table for a little while.
Hey, you said we had furniture for about 6 weeks, four weeks, 6 weeks. But we got through it.
We got through it.
And then when you were relatively young, you guys had a baby together.
We did.
And beautiful Andre came into the world.
Yes.
Talk me through... how old were you, first of all, when you had Andre?
So I was 22 when we fell pregnant, and then 3 days after my 23rd birthday, he was born.
So almost on your 23rd birthday, you had your first baby.
Yeah, yep.
How did you process having a baby at such a young age?
Oh, we weren't ready, you know, at the time. It was very much a
How do you mean? When you say you're not ready, in what particular way? Emotionally,
financially, maturity? We were, to put it into context, so in June of that year when I fell pregnant, we got engaged and we'd just moved into our first home that we'd purchased together. So broke the mold there, you know, with the family as well. You can't possibly live together without being married.
Did you have pressures from the folks and from other members of the family just out of interest?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a bit of it, but I think because of the man that Nick is, it was okay. I think had it been anyone else, I think it would have been a no-fly zone, you know. But because of who he is and because we shared this vision for our lives together and they understood that, they kind of let it slide a little bit, you know. And then so it was June, moved in, got engaged, and then by October I was pregnant on birth control, like religiously taking it, and, you know, this miracle child, you know, came into our orbit. We were, you know, just bought this house and had no money, like, you know, it was hard.
Describe to me how hard.
He was, earning, I think at that stage back then, he's like, you know, what, 10 years ago or whatever, he would have been on like 50 grand or something, 55 grand a year, working in commercial construction. So he was doing the hard yards, you know, like putting in the effort, putting in the hours on, you know, very entry-level income. And we just weren't financially at a point in our lives where we were ready. Emotionally, we were kids, you know. We both weren't ready for it. But we just knew that this is what the plan for us was, you know.
It's meant to be.
You kind of grit your teeth and get on with it. And then looking back on it now, it's the best thing that ever happened, because it's like not having that backup plan, you know. It's kind of like, this is what your life is, so you're going to make it work. And I think while the whole journey for me being a young mum was extremely challenging in that I didn't really know who I was, you know, let alone, you know, when women talk about losing their identity when you become a mother, you go from being, you know, Emma to Andre's mum, right? I wasn't even Emma at that point. I was a baby. You know, I was 22 years of age.
So you hadn't even really discovered yourself.
No.
Yeah, okay.
No. So I didn't even really know at that point what my path in life and what my journey was meant to look like, or what I wanted it to look like, or what my real values were. It was so early into moving out and not being under, you know, your family kind of family rules and the family, you know, roof and all of that. Like you're trying to make your own way in the world and get to know yourself. And then, oh, surprise, there's a baby coming. And at that, you know, at that point, like we had the wedding planned and we had, you know, this like life kind of planned out together, and it all kind of shifted because I was adamant that I wanted to get married before the baby came. So it was kind of like this weird shotgun, you know, thing. Had to cancel the wedding. We lost deposits to bring it all forward. And, you know, again, it kind of allowed me to have what I actually really wanted, which is strange because we had this big walk wedding, you know, planned. It was 250 people and at the big, you know, the big ceremony and the this and that and all the fanfare around it. And then in my heart, like I always wanted a small wedding, intimate, you know, thing. So we went from that to having at my dream venue, we had 65 people and it was the best thing that could have happened, you know. So I got what I wanted in the end, but just had to.
Where was your dream venue?
So we got married at Com, which is 7 Alfred Place in the city. So like top end of Collins Street, just a historical building, really beautiful interiors, you know, of course, but it's just super intimate and, you know, amazing food and just like the quality over quantity.
Yeah.
You know, and that's always been such a big thing for
the
me.
Mantra.
Yeah. And it follows through to business as well, you know, in our values. But yeah, I really didn't want that big do, and you feel the pressure and you don't want to upset anybody and you just go with the flow, right? And at that age, like you don't have the convictions yet to say no, to say, I don't want that. I don't feel like that's the right thing for us. I don't want to spend all that money on this thing that I don't feel like I need, you know, just for people you never see. Like, you're not old enough yet to push back, I think. But yeah, it just gave us the opportunity to get what we wanted without, yeah.
So looking back then, like you said, you've had a chance to reflect on a lot of things and mm-hmm. motherhood and your parents and your grandparents and Nick and mm-hmm. Andre. While it was incredible, sounds like it was incredibly challenging emotionally, mentally, financially, all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
How much, again, similar to what I asked you before, how much do you think it's made you as a person? What sort of challenges do you think that you've gone through during that period that have now, looking back on it,
mm-hmm.
Changed who you became during that process?
So I think because early days when Andre was born, like I was back at work and he was not even 3 months old. Like he was 8 weeks old and we had that little like cash.
So
that,
you were back super quick.
Dude, like we just – so quick. And if
– So is this when mum essentially retired from
– Pretty much.
From
the second I got pregnant, like she decided that that's what she was going to do.
Understand.
Yeah.
Okay, I understand.
Because she's
why
like,
now.
You guys are just kids. You're just starting. Like yeah, how right, can right. you know. It was hard on her. Like I remember trying on my wedding dress Branko and my mum's face – like as a girl, it's like you dream of this day of like, you know, going and having your bridal fitting with your mom and all that. And to her credit, she still made it so amazing and our wedding was still so beautiful and everything. But like it wasn't what anyone had like probably envisaged. So I remember being at the bridal fitting and I'm trying on this dress and it looked amazing and I felt like a princess, you know. And my mom's just looking at me with this like stunned mullet, like dead stare in her eyes, like just – It was hard. It was hard to see her kind of like
she was probably
that.
Processing.
She was processing
everything that she maybe was expecting as well in that particular
this
moment.
It's her baby girl.
Yeah.
You know, and she didn't see her baby girl being pregnant at, you know, 22 years of age, getting married. Like she just, it wasn't what she thought was going to happen. Mm. None of us did. Mm. So it was that shock, I think. And I think me seeing her kind of face like that too was, right, like this is like real. You know,
so
and then yeah, it meant I had to make it count.
So then just in terms of specific things, mm-hmm. specific lessons
yep.
that you've learnt as a woman
mm-hmm.
going through that and having a baby at an early age,
yep.
when you reflect now, you know, 5, 10 years, 12 mm-hmm. years down the track,
yep.
what specific things do you think as a woman during that period made you? Does that make sense what I'm asking?
Yep. I think it's the ability to push through that mental stress and how to get through it, because it was so challenging for me having to leave him so early. No mother wants to do that.
I was going
to
ask you, how did you process that?
Like, just really poorly, you know, I just continued to work through it, basically.
That's going to require that.
It's that Terminator bloody mentality. Like, my dad, you know, like, it's, you just got to keep going. You got to keep pushing. You got to keep, you know, going through it. So dad used to actually come and pick up Andre. He was like, yeah, three months old. He'd come before work at like 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, drive from Hoppers to Point Cook, pick up Andre, take him to mum's house so that I didn't have to like drive. I'm spoiled, I know. But he would do that for me so that I could get Andre ready. He was comfortable. He was not getting in and out of the car and moving around too much. Get him ready, you know, have his bottle or whatever, and then I'd go to work. And back then, you know, I felt this need to, you know, go and do like the corporate thing, because it was that mentality of making it count. Like, I keep talking about that and going back to that. But I didn't want to just have like a mediocre kind of job and not earn good money or anything like that. And there was a time there where, because I was working in real estate when I felt pregnant. And then after I had Andre, I felt like I couldn't go back to real estate because I go all in. You know, that's just my personality.
To double down.
You know, it's like there's no half toe in the water with me. It's like if you're doing something, you're doing it well, you know. You all in or nothing.
So terminated like that.
Yes, 100%. So when I had Andre, I was like, I can't possibly go all in real estate with a three-month-old child and work 7 days a week and do the hours I was doing, you know, and do opens and photo shoots at 8 o'clock at night. And like, you just can't with a baby, yeah? It's a lot of pressure to put on my mum too, to have that expectation of like, you've got my kid 24 hours a day.
Mm. How were you processing that? Was there a sense of, I guess, guilt?
Huge guilt.
If you want to call it that.
Yep. Huge guilt. I had to do therapy. I was not coping at all. It was like probably a combination of postnatal and also just that overwhelming like fear and like, it just felt mental. That first probably 12 months was just chaos in my mind, you know. And just like I was always looking for these little dopamine kind of spikes, like this little kind of thing here and there, and not actually having like a clear vision of what I really wanted and what was going to make me happy. And it's just a blur. Like, I look back on it now and I was so just not present in my life. I was like living someone else's life for 12 months when he was young. And it's sad because I look back on it now and it's like I missed out on that time with him. But, you know, it really forged that tenacity and that drive in me and that ability to very quickly figure out what's for me and what's not for me. Because when you're making those sacrifices and being away from your son, you know, the biggest lesson, I'll go back and finally answer your question, but that the biggest lesson for me was, you know, what's the point in doing all of this and being away from him and, you know, not giving him 100% if you're not going to give this other thing 100%, right? And if that thing's not right for you, just don't pretend it is.
Because you're ultimately doing all of this for him.
It's all for him.
At the end of the day, right?
100%. And, you know, to be fair, I've learned over the last 8 years that that's probably not the best way to be. You know, it's not all for your kids. You've got to be able to do it for you first and fill your own cup so that you can give them. You can't pour from an empty cup and all that, whatever. But very much back then it was like, I need to give it 110% because financially, like, my family needs me to succeed, you know.
So then it's been a constant process of self-evaluation, self-assessment, and iteration, if you want to call it that, of tweaking and so-called testing and looking back on what you've done well, where you may be questioning yourself or self-sabotaging in a way and creating the best life forward. And even now, like you say, 8 years down the track, Andre's 8 years old now, I assume.
He'll be nine in June.
Okay, so he'll be nine shortly. So let's say for the last 8 years you've been processing this and dealing this with this sort of stuff in your own way, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
And then on the flip side of it, I'd like to ask you then, while he's been away from you during a lot of that period in his early life, he spent a fair bit of it with his grandparents.
Yes.
On the flip side, there have been some challenges for you, naturally, but there's always a silver lining, isn't there? And the silver lining there is that, you know, he's in after mum, he's in the best possible hands possible, and that is in your parents' hands. So
exactly.
Let me just ask you then, the relationship that Andre has then with Silvana being his grandma and Bill, his grandfather.
Yeah. So he often says, like, he's got two mums, you know, he's got, like, two sets of parents. And he really does, because they've got such a beautiful bond and it's so special. And, I mean, I had it with my grandma because she looked after us, but what they've got is even beyond that, because the amount of time that they've had to spend together, you know, like when I was working, you know, corporate, it was the whole elongated work day. It was like I got to work at 7 a.m. and, you know, you would finish your actual work day at probably 6, but then, you know, you're expected to do the work drinks after work and, you know, that whole culture.
Mm.
So at those like first kind of 6 months of me working and him being at mum's, like he was there like all the time, you know, which probably attributed to how difficult it was like mentally and emotionally for me. But it meant that he's had this beautiful time from very, very young with her. And it's a different level, because when it's a parent, you're fatigued because it's 24 hours. But when it's a grandparent, you know, and they're as young as what my mum is, she's been able to give him the very best of herself during the time that they're together, but then she gets a rest when he would come home, you know, and be with me in the evening. And I got the opportunity to be very present at work, knowing that he was 100% safe and happy. It didn't matter if he was a little bit flu-y or a little bit sick. It wasn't childcare where he was, you know, then expected to be picked up. Like, he was with my mum.
So there was did you guys then make a conscious effort as a family to say, hey, no childcare, we don't want him in childcare, or he doesn't need
to be in
childcare?
We couldn't afford it.
Okay.
Yeah, so there wouldn't have been.
Financial decision as well.
There's just like no way. Like, for, you know, entry level, I was so young, like you're on entry level wages. There's no way we could have afforded childcare. So that's why my mum left her job.
It's a lot of considerations, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you're right.
She knew that before I even knew that, you know.
And you're right with that dynamic with grandparents, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's a special relationship, it's a special bond. And
I've
probably never thought about it in the way that you've just sort of expressed it and articulated. So beautifully, I reckon, in that you do actually get a break, whereas parents, it's go, 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 middle of the night, day, night, afternoon. It doesn't matter what time it is. It is relentless is the great word. It's a good thing. It's a nice problem to have, but it is something for consideration. If you do have some options where you do have the luxury of having somebody there to help you, then.
And it is such a luxury, and like I'm very aware of that, and I know that not everybody is able to have that. Which just drives me so much more, because you've got to, again, make it count.
He's a beautiful boy.
He's
very handsome, and he's super clever.
He's very clever.
I've only been around him probably 3 or 4 times, but he's super, super switched on at a young age already. He's sort of, you know, in a way, mature beyond his years. As weird as that might sound for a 7 or 8 year old, that's how I found being around him and just interacting with him.
He's definitely
as much as I have.
The best of both of us. But, you know, he's also an only child, so he's been around adults his whole life. Predominantly, there's no kids really in our family apart from him, you know. It's only obviously if you look at it like age group wise and our friendship groups and that kind of stuff, they're all just having kids now. So they've got 1-year-olds or like the newborn babies, and he's this 9-year-old kid, you know. So a lot of his life was left, you know, there was no kids around him. So that's why he's mature.
So Andre is obviously a massive part of your life. Nick's a massive part of your life. Your parents are a massive part of your life. You mentioned your brother Adrian as well before. You guys are siblings. There's just the two of you. Explain the dynamic between the two of you and what sort of influence he's had on your life and maybe vice versa, do you think?
I think
sound like you get along famously.
We do. He's the best. I think when I was younger, it's weird because he's my little brother, but if you ever get to know him, he's like my big little brother, you know. Like I'm kind of the wild, crazy, you know, eclectic, weird person in our family, and he's like the solid, you know.
But again, he's another one that like I haven't met him many times, but a bit like Andre's sort of, and like Nick.
Yeah.
Nick's, they're all sort of mature beyond their years. They're all,
way.
They're all, I don't know. It's, yeah. it's a thing in your family. The boys seem, not that you're not, but but the boys very much particularly seem to be very mature beyond their years.
Like he's a, Adrian's a goofball. Like everyone who knows him will tell you that. But he's also, yeah, from very young, very mature. It's like switched on, yeah. motivated, driven. You know, he's the type of kid, like he was, I was out, you know, as a kid, Christmas money, it would be blown straight away, you know. Him, save every little cent, yeah, put it away. One day I'm going to do this, one day I'm going to do that. And he has, and he's, you know, for his age, what he's been able to achieve has been so amazing to watch. And I'm so proud of him. And, you know, he works in the family business and works alongside Dad. And it's nice to see them growing, you know, Dad's business together now. And
did he learn everything basically under – was Dad essentially
– yeah,
was so he a Dad's apprentice? Is yeah. that essentially
yeah. so age how he learned? Dropped out of school. I think he finished year 10 and then year 11, year 12, he was at trade school.
Okay. So he's what now – you said what, 3 or 4 years younger than you?
Yeah, I think he's 3 years, yeah, yeah. younger than me.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he's in his late 20s now.
He is.
Doing really well.
Yep. Met the love of his life and he's, you know, engaged great. Now and, you know, he's bought the house and he's, yeah, he's just, he's a great, great kid. And I think he, you know, you say like you stand on, I think we spoke about it before, you stand on the shoulders. Yeah.
To get to where
exactly.
you are.
Like I definitely stood on his shoulders. Growing up, like he was the one, you know, that would help out. After dinner, like he'd be sweeping the floor or helping mum out and, you know, doing all those things. And I was like studying, you know, and doing my thing and creating and drawing and, you know, doing all these things while he kind of stepped up and helped out around the house and helped out in the garden and did all that kind of stuff. But yeah, he's such a great brother. I've got a lot of respect for age.
So then if that's the, you guys sound like you made a pretty good team as a brother and sister. Would you then say, again, just to finish up on the background and your parents and your the way you grew up, would you then describe your parents as the ultimate team?
Yep.
Like a power couple.
Yeah, like the power couple.
Because that seems to be how you've framed them up. Like
yeah.
everyone's kind of in a way played their role and
yes.
helping you and obviously yep. Adrian.
And I don't mean to romanticize it because it's not like all happy families and like this, you know, pretend perfection. Like
but that's
it's,
been your path, though, your family journey though, right?
Yeah, but it's a conscious effort that every single member of our family makes on a daily basis to continue to do that. So it's not like this romantic idea of, you know, oh, they're just a power couple and it just comes so naturally and easy and they just work so nicely together. Mm. No, like every day. They wake up and choose
yeah.
that path. It's probably the biggest lesson, isn't it?
Mm. I think that there's something to be said about that because people just think it just falls into your lap.
Mm.
You think it's just a natural – but like with anything in life, you've got to work at it. If you go to the gym, you're not going to get muscles by sitting there looking at the fucking weights. You've got to
put in the effort.
Push hard.
It's a conscious effort and decision to wake up every day and choose that life. You know, when you don't want to, when it's hard, when you want to just say, you know what, fuck it, I've had enough today. I don't want to look at you, you know. But when Nick and I got married, like my dad said to us, best advice I can ever give you kids is don't ever go to bed angry at each other. You know, make up even if you don't want to, even if you can't stand to look at her. You know, before you go to sleep and shut your eyes, reconcile,
yep.
you know, because – it's not good to harbour on that negative, you know, energy because I think if you hold on to that, that's how I think really great relationships start to crumble when you hold on to that resentment.
And it's normally from finicky things, ego-driven, pride-driven bullshit, mm-hmm. you know, that we all can sometimes get trapped into with any sort of relationship with a spouse, with a family member, mm-hmm. you know, brothers and sisters, work colleagues, friends, and like you just ruin a perfectly magnificent relationship over something so fickle and bullshit. Oh,
and bullshit.
And yep. all of a sudden it unravels so quickly. You take so many years to build up this magnificent relationship and all of a sudden just over something so small that things can just unravel. Pull that thread and
yeah.
just all of it goes.
You know what it is? The people that you love, I think, are the first ones to cop it too. Like if you're having a difficult time, at work you can put on the brave face and, you know, you're with your colleagues and yeah, everything's good and hunky-dory and da-da-da, but then you get home and it all, you're yourself, you're, you know, who you really are. Mm. And then that person, that poor person sitting there and you unload, you know, and they cop the brunt of it. And I think it's easy sometimes, and poor Nick cops it from me all the time, because we grew up in that type of, you know, very emotional, emotive, passionate family dynamic where we said everything that we felt, you know, which his family kind of probably didn't. So he'll sometimes take, like, sit it there and take it. But it's also the other person's ability, like if, and he does it, you know, too. Everyone, of course, has their moments, but you've got to be able to take that person and their kind of anguish in that moment and not take it against them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and be able to let them kind of have their moment to, this, that,
we've got to vent.
Vent. But then don't take it personal because you've got to understand that you're that person's closest person. So, you know, let them vent and then afterwards, hey.
But that's why they're that's why they're willing to vent, because they have the trust. It's a safe space.
It's safe.
It's the
unconditional love.
Yeah, that's what it is, you know, and I think that those people are the most likely to do it to you because you're the most cherished and closest person to them possible. Exactly. So you almost need to take it as a you know, notch in the belt in a way to say, hey, well, they rely on me, they trust me.
Yeah. And be able to turn it around too and not let them, you know, like if I'm in a really negative headspace, like Nick will help me out of it instead of like ramping it up and making me angrier.
But I think a good partner or a good mate or a good whoever, the listener in that environment, a great listener, great friend, great spouse will know that it's not about them. It's about the person that's venting to you.
Yep.
And for you to turn around and say, oh, why are you dumping all this shit on me?
Exactly.
You're dumping that shit on you because they trust you, they rely on you, they believe in you, they want to share that experience with you as good or bad as it might be. So.
Yeah.
There you go. So going to some deep spaces.
I know, geez.
It's good. So we've been through the family stuff. What I'd like to talk to you about is your work life. You know, we've touched on some careers and we obviously know what you do now, which we'll speak about your business very shortly. But early work life, early bosses that you've come across, early colleagues, early lessons. You spoke about real estate. What did you love? Why did you want to get into real estate in the early throws? What inspired you to get into the game? And is it just the motherhood and Andre element when you got out of it? Was that the reason primarily you got out?
Even to this day, I love real estate and I love property. And that was why I got into it. So
what specifically do you love about it though? I love property, I love real estate. It's a pretty broad, it's a broad thing. But what specifically drew you to want to be someone that sells it?
I think I wanted to really help people. Again, it's like this whole lifestyle thing, right? It's the means to an end. So I love helping people connect with their homes, and real estate's a way to connect people and homes, you know. And it was the whole thing. Like I love the drive and, you know, the thing with real estate, you know, better than anyone, it's how hard you work and how dedicated you are to it. If you work hard at it, you'll see success, right? There's a lot of industries that aren't like that. You can kind of be on the hamster wheel and go, and
you're capped.
You're kind of capped, you know, whereas I liked the idea that with real estate, I was kind of running my own race and I was able to be whatever I wanted to be long term. But at the really core of it, I think it's always been about the actual house, you know, the home, the people within those walls and helping them find these homes that become where they create all of their memories and being in the right fit. And, you know, that was really it. And it's, again, like a romanticized idea of it, right, because it's not always like that. But that was the initial early days. Why?
So what surprised you about the industry when you were – on the other side of it, so the love and romanticism of it all gets you in there, and the thrill of the hunt, so to speak, in a way. Once you're in the mix of it, once we're all in the mix of it, we see it in a different light. What was that light for you, and how did you see it comparable to what that maybe perception was before you got into it?
I think the main difference for me was I knew it was going to be hard work. But it takes a lot of time, you know, a lot of time. And if you're someone like me, I value time above money. So that's just my personal outlook on life. I think time is the most valuable thing that we have on this earth. So when you value time so greatly and then you're in an industry where you have to give it literally every waking moment of your life is real estate. You live it, breathe it. If you want to be successful, you can coast through. Yeah, sure. You know, you can be at the office and go for lattes and, you know, the typical real estate life that people think an agent has, right? That you're at the cafe half the day and you're just talking shit to people on the phone, whatever. But if you want to really succeed, and I was very fortunate. Early in my real estate career, I was working with Chantal Considine, who's an incredible mentor of mine. I've got the utmost respect for her. Very early on through Josh Vegan, she was able to coordinate a visit for myself and her to Alexander Phillips' office in Sydney. And that it's funny how these things in your life, like now you think, oh, real estate, what's got nothing to do really with what direction the business has taken. But being around people like that and seeing the way that they operate at that level and seeing very early on in my career, if you want to make it, like properly really make it, you know, like he'd be in the office at 7 o'clock in the morning with his, you know, headpiece on making calls and just like an absolute machine, you know, like it's just the drive and the direction that I was able to see just for a brief, like it was a brief, very brief visit. But it really showed me what it took to be at the top of your game, you know. And you take those lessons and you transfer them into what you're doing for the rest of your life. Like when you see somebody, I'd never been exposed to anybody like that before that moment.
In any career?
Any career.
Yeah.
You know, like you see people and especially in sales, like everything, you know, that I'd kind of done to that point in my life was in some way related to sales, I guess, apart from probably the teaching thing. And I'd never seen anyone, you know, operate like that, you know, and seeing Chantal and being this, you know, incredible female, like woman in business and the way that she tackled things systematically and took that care and, it was like seeing both sides of the coin. I didn't know that you could be both. You could have that compassion and that care and still hold on to your feminine kind of energy but also be like a weapon and get on with it and tackle things in a certain way. And then taking it to that next level and going and seeing, you know, Alex Phillips and the way that he runs his business and his PA Prue and the what she was able to, you know, help him with in his business at that time, it was really eye-opening for me.
And those of you that are listening to this that are maybe not in real estate, Alexander Phillips, or Alex as he's known to most of his colleagues, I don't know Alex at all, but mm-hmm. One of the handful of number one operators in the country, number one agent I think now these days in Australia. Mm. He's based out of Sydney and phenomenal agent, runs a EBU, effective business unit of I think 4 or 5 people now. Prue runs the ship there. Or she has done for a long time. I assume she still does. Mm. And Chantal, Jealous Craig in the North these days with Johnny Morello and the team down there. So run a great business down there. So some pretty good people you were around in the early stages. And that really does help frame if you're in an industry, doesn't matter what it is, real estate or teaching or styling, if you're around the right team, the right people and the right mentors and the right people that guide you, you can have success really, really early, can't you?
Mm, I think so. I think it's also just being exposed to it. Like a lot of the time, I think if you're not shown another way, it's like when we're talking about, you know, Nick and taking me to the supper club. Before then, I never knew that there's this whole world existed. You know, when I was in real estate, I didn't know that this level of success existed, you know. I was very young at both these points in my life. So it's having that exposure to more and then being able to decide what you want to take, what lessons you want to take out of it and apply to your own life, you know.
And then going by what you said before, you're one of those people that like you said, terminator, like we used the terminology before, but boots and all,
yep.
Chips in the middle of the table. Mm-hmm. Did you look at it like, okay, I've seen literally a master in his field at the height of his game in Alexander, and I'm a mum, I've just had a child, and if I can't perform it to that level, I don't want to perform it at all. Is that
Is that a fair assessment of maybe how you're thinking, or am I way off?
No, that's 100% it. So we went and had that visit, and then I found out I was pregnant not long after that. So for me, it was 100% that. It was like, I want to be the best I can possibly be, and I know what that takes, and I can't reasonably continue to do that. And that was like a huge shift, I think, in my mind too, where if I can't go all in, I don't even want to do it, you know. And then I naively thought that starting a business was going to be
it's a different beast altogether, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Any other industries you sort of dabbled in or did in your early 20s, mid-20s before you started sort of not mid-20s but more early 20s or not particularly?
Yeah, so I mean it was just that stint that I did in recruitment was probably – that was, you know, when I say corporate, that's what I was referring to then. So when right after I had Andre, so doing those long hours, you know, I thought it was going to be different to real estate. It wasn't. You didn't work the Saturday.
It's still a salesy job, isn't it? Recruitment.
Yeah. It was the same.
It's people versus real estate, right?
Exactly. You're still transactions, you know, still sales targets and goals and all of that, which I don't mind. I like all of that, you know. I love talking to people. I love sales in that sense. But it just wasn't filling my cup up, and it had no element of creativity for me, and the culture wasn't for me, you know. I think, you know, recruitment has a lot of like expats and, you know, people who are kind of just here to try to make money. It's very like financially driven, and they don't have necessarily like a lot going on outside of, you know, work. So these people are there like all the time, you know, 7 till 9 o'clock drinking after work or whatever. Just with a young baby, I had, you know, my head was just in two different places at once. So I knew very early on that it wasn't for me. And then, shortly after I started studying and went down that path with interiors, and I've just never looked back.